Today we're going to look at the life of an Old Testament Bible character that I've always found interesting and been wanting to do a study on him. And it's so big, we're just going to kind of hit some highlights because we only have just the one lesson. But we're looking at the life of Joab in the Old Testament. Joab was David's nephew, King David, a man after God's own heart. He was the king. And Joab was his nephew and also his general and military leader for pretty much his entire reign. And he's a fascinating character because he's never really the main character of any of the Bible stories that he's in. He's always just sort of a side guy that's in the background. But for being a side character, he shows up a lot. He is just constantly, partly because he's a big part of King David's life, but he's really prominent as that side character. He gets a lot of screen time. And so a lot of people study the life of David, but to me it's interesting to take a look at somebody who's kind of in the background of most of David's life and kind of just look at some of the highlights. So we're going to give a little background on David and Joab and how they contrast a little bit, and then we're going to look at seven highlights from Joab's life. I think the key thing to remember about both David and Joab is they were just both men, meaning that they were both fallible. David, because he's called a man after God's own heart, and because he's Israel's greatest king, it's very easy to look at stories of David in Scripture and then just kind of go like, well, he's like the best guy in the Bible after Jesus, pretty much. And so anything David does is pretty much right all the time, and anything anyone else does around him is bad, except for that whole Bathsheba thing. Other than that, David's always right. And that's really not the case either. David messes up a lot. What I think that he's called a man after God's own heart is he's always pursuing what God wants, and even when he messes up, he's quick to repent, he's quick to turn, and he's quick to look to God for forgiveness and mercy. It's interesting when you look at them. David was called a man after God's own heart in 1 Samuel 13:14, when Samuel is talking to Saul, the previous king, and he says, "Your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart. And the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." So, if I was to describe David in one word, all of the good and all of the bad, David was a man of passion. He was a man of deep passion and deep emotion. He wrote most of the Psalms, so he is a very excellent, powerful musician. He pursued God passionately and really chased after him with all that he had. And at the same time, when he was led astray into sin, it was usually by his passions, by his emotions, either his lust for Bathsheba, or also later on in his life, David takes a census of the people, which was another great wicked act that God had commanded him not to. And again, it was David being led astray by his emotions. He felt insecure in what God had promised him, and so he wanted to count the people to make sure he had enough soldiers and put his trust in his own devices. So his passion. His two biggest weaknesses were his licentiousness and his unwillingness to discipline those under his authority. David was a lusty guy. He had a problem with women, and it wasn't just Bathsheba. He took lots and lots and lots of wives and lots and lots and lots of concubines, and they caused it lots and lots and lots of problems. That was an issue for David. And then he was also, David had an unwillingness to discipline those under his authority. He would frequently turn a blind eye to stuff that was going on that he knew he should deal with, and he wouldn't. And that was one of David's great weaknesses, even though he was a good man of God. Joab was David's nephew, the son of his older sister. It's not stated specifically, but we kind of think that they're closer to the same age than not, even though he was David's nephew. Because David was the youngest of his siblings, Joab was from a much older sibling, and at the time David is old and dying, he refers to Joab's hoary head, which means gray or white. So Joab was an old man by the time David was an old man also. And if you were going to describe David or Joab in one word, if David was passionate, Joab was very cunning. Joab was very cunning. He always had an angle. He always had something he was up to, some angle he was going to pursue, and he was a sharp guy. He was very talented, very intelligent, and so he was very cunning. He was a brilliant military commander. Joab was made the general of David's army for a reason, and he just wins battle after battle after battle. Part of it is, I think, he's on the side of God, and God is fighting for David, certainly. But Joab is shown repeatedly to be a sharp guy that knows what he's doing when it comes to leading an army. And the third thing is, Joab is extremely loyal. He has hitched his wagon to David, and he is all about David. His two biggest weaknesses, if you were to point out Joab's weaknesses, is he's extremely willing to commit violence. He is a man of war and a man of killing, and he will just murder somebody at the drop of a hat if he feels that they need to die. And his second weakness is, even though Joab is extremely loyal, he's shown repeatedly to be loyal to David, not necessarily loyal to God. And that's a huge problem when you put your loyalty to the wrong thing. Even though David was a good man, even though David was a man of God, he was loyal to David, and even when David was going to mess up, Joab was going to back him 100%. And that was a big problem that, again, caused a lot of issues because of that. So we're going to look, like I said, at a few highlights of his life. Like I said, you could pack in a ton of stuff about Joab because it goes on for a while, but we're going to read a lot of text. We're going to start in 2 Samuel chapter 2. 2 Samuel chapter 2. This is where Joab kind of first appears on the scene in a big way. And it starts, Saul has died, the king previous to David, and David is technically taken over as king. But one of Saul's sons raises himself up as a king as well, and there is a civil war that is being fought. And it's David and his people that are following, trying to make him king, versus Saul's son and his people trying to make them king. And we're going to start in verse 8 of chapter 2 of 2 Samuel. And it says, "But Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him to Mahanaim. He made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, over Benjamin, even over all Israel. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he was king for 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. The time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Now Abner, the son of Ner, went out from Menahem to Gibeon with the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon, and they sat down, one on one side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. Then Abner said to Joab, 'Now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us.' And Joab said, 'Let them arise.' So they arose and went out by count, 12 from Benjamin and 12 for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. Each one of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword into his side so that they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called, a word I'm not even going to try and pronounce, which is in Gibeon. That day, the battle was very severe." So evidently, this big contest they were holding was just sort of a preamble to a fight that they knew they were going to have. "And Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. Now the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Asahel. Asahel was as swift-footed as one of the gazelles which is in the field. He pursued Abner and did not let him turn to the right or the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, 'Is that you, Asahel?' And he said, 'It is I.' So Abner said to him, 'Turn to your right or to your left and take hold one of the young men for yourself and take for yourself his spoil.' But Asahel was not willing to turn aside from following him." Abner repeated his warning. And then in verse 30 or 23, it says, "However, he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the belly with the butt end of the spear so that the spear came out his back, and he fell there and died in the spot. And it came about that all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still." So this is Joab's brother, and they're fighting a battle here in this civil war that's being held between Saul's son as king and David. And in that battle, it's going badly for Saul's forces, so they take off leaving, and his general and one of Joab's brothers starts chasing him down. And in the battle, he tries to tell him not to chase him, but he won't, so then he turns and kills him. Joab does not like that he killed his brother. In verse 30, it says, "Then Joab returned from following Abner," because he kept trying to chase him but couldn't catch him. "When he had gathered all the people together, 19 of David's servants besides Asahel were missing. But the servants of David had struck down many of Benjamin and Abner's men so that 360 men had died." So David's forces had 20 men die and the other guys had 360 men die. Did I mention Joab knows what he's doing when it comes to the military? But Joab's brother is among the fallen. And we get into chapter 3, that becomes an even bigger deal. In verse 1, it says, "Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew weaker continually." It talks about all the sons he had, blah, blah, blah. Verse 6, the sons aren't relevant to this story that we're looking at, and we got a lot of ground to cover. "It came about while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David that Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, and Ishbosheth said to Abner, 'Why have you gone into my father's concubine?' Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, 'Am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show kindness to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hands of David, and yet today you charge me with a guilt concerning the woman. May God do so to Abner and more also if, as the Lord has sworn to David, I do not accomplish for him.'" Verse 10, "to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and establish the throne of David over Israel and Judah from Dan even to Beersheba." So Abner goes to visit David with kind of a peace treaty idea that I will help you become king. And if I say you're king, everyone that is following this false king is really just following me because I'm the commander of Saul's army. The civil war will be over and I want to make you king. David said, "Boy, that sounds great." So they met in peace and they were all happy. Abner goes to leave. Skip down to verse 22. "And behold, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away and he had gone in peace." Verse 23, "When Joab and all the army that was with him arrived, they told Joab, 'Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king and he has sent him away and he has gone in peace.' Then Joab came to the king and said, 'What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why have you sent him away and he is already gone? You know, Abner, the son of Ner, that he came to deceive you and to learn of your going out and your coming in and to find out all that you are doing.'" In verse 26, "When Joab came out from David, he sent messengers after Abner and they brought him back from the well of Surah, but David did not know it. So when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the middle of the gate to speak with him privately, and there he struck him in the belly so that he died on account of the blood of Asahel, his brother. Afterward, when David heard of it, he said, 'I and my kingdom are innocent before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall on the head of Joab and on all his father's house, and may there not fail from the house of Joab one who has a discharge or who is a leper or who takes hold of a distaff or who falls by the sword or who lacks bread.' So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon." Verse 31, "Then David said to Joab and all the people who were with him, 'Tear your clothes and gird sackcloth and lament before Abner.' And King David walked behind the bier." And they have a big funeral for them. And David is very, very distraught and makes a big deal about mourning for Abner. And in verse 39, at the end of the chapter, David says, "I am weak today, though anointed king. And these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too difficult for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil." This is kind of a strange story to me on a whole bunch of different counts. Saul has finally died. David was hiding in the wilderness for years from him. He is now ready to become king. And yet, no, the nation doesn't want to unite under him. This Abner character, I'm going to be honest here. This is Josiah's reading of the thing. He sounds sort of worthless. He's the one who set up Ishbosheth as the king. He's the one who wouldn't help David. And then at the start of the chapter, it talks about the war goes on for years. And as the war is continuing, David is getting stronger and stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul is getting weaker and weaker and weaker. Again, did I mention Joab, David's general, is pretty good at waging war. And then Abner starts to think, maybe I'm on the losing side. And then he starts taking a concubine that the king didn't want him to, and so then he gets upset and says, well, now I'm going to go join David. So you go, okay, you're finally seeing the light. At the same time, this war has gone on for years and caused presumably hundreds of deaths, and largely as a result of Abner. That's not good. At the same time, David recognized the opportunity for peace, and David recognized the opportunity for healing, and Joab wasn't about to have anything to do with that, and so he murders him in cold blood. And David clearly feels there's a distinction between killing someone in battle and luring someone into an alleyway and stabbing them in cold blood. And once again here we see there are two weaknesses I talked about. Joab is so quick to commit violence. He is so quick to get angry and kill someone, and he is cold and cunning and calculating. He lures him back under false pretenses, and then he murders him. At the same time, we also here again see one of David's great weaknesses. if Joab has done this great wickedness, which David clearly says he has, and clearly says he's a terrible person, and clearly says he curses him and his entire household, and then does absolutely nothing about it. And you go, if you really felt that he had murdered him unjustly, shouldn't you punish Joab? But David was not willing to deal always with those under his authority in the way that he should. And again, this is going to seed and cause problems. And again, I think it was also probably a complex political situation for David, because I would imagine that if they had been waging a civil war for years, Joab was not the only one who hated the enemy general. And Joab was not the only one who had lost family members or friends to the enemy army. And therefore, Joab was probably not the only one that was a little bit disgruntled that David was welcoming in the enemy. So David just sort of sidesteps it. Again, it highlights both men's weak points of their character. We're just going to touch on that, but when we come back to this, at the end of Joab's life, we're going to see throughout their lives, David continually sows seeds of mercy and forgiveness. He does it with Saul's family. He does it with Jonathan's family. He does it to Joab here. He's constantly sowing mercy. And God returns that to him in forms of mercy when David does wrong. Joab is constantly sowing seeds of vengeance. If somebody does Joab wrong, Joab's going to get him. And as we'll see at the end of his life, he reaps a harvest of vengeance as well, because it comes back to him. And it's interesting to me how both men sow different types of things into their lives and reap different rewards from that. Go to 2 Samuel chapter 10. We're going to hit on another highlight of Joab's life. This happens after David has been king for a while. This neighboring nation of Amnon, they send them diplomats, and they take the Israelite diplomats and disgrace them. They shave their heads and send them back and basically spit in their face and say, we don't like you or want anything to do with you. And the Israelites take offense of it. So in chapter 10 of 2 Samuel in verse 7, it says, when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the army, the mighty men. The sons of Ammon came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the city, while the Arameans of Zobah and Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the field. Now when Joab saw that the battle was set against him in the front and in the rear, he selected from the choice men of Israel and arrayed them against the Arameans. But the remainder of the people he placed in the hand of Abishai his brother, and he arrayed them against the sons of Ammon. And he said, if the Arameans are too strong for me, then you shall come and help me. But if the sons of Amnon are too strong for you, then I will come and help you. Verse 12 here is interesting. He says, be strong and let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what is good in his sight. So when Joab and the people who were with him drew near to the battle against the Arameans, they fled before him. And when the sons of Amnon saw that the Arameans fled, they also fled before Abishai and entered the city. And then Joab returned from fighting against the sons of Amnon and came to Jerusalem. Once again, it's interesting how much David relies on Joab. There's this big thing. David's the king, and yet he just sends Joab with the army and go take care of it. Joab does a lot of wild stuff, and David never seems to punish him for it. And I think that a big part of that is David did not want to lose his right-hand man in general, because he was very effective. And so David valued his effectiveness more than maybe what was right in a lot of circumstances. But here, Joab goes out. He finds himself outnumbered and surrounded. And so he splits his army in two, and they fight on two fronts and win. But I like that what he said in verse 12, let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God. And be strong and courageous, and then, and may the Lord do what is good in his sight. And 2020 has been an interesting year, full of lots of interesting occurrences. Lots of fun challenges. Locally, we've had droughts. Nationally, there's all sorts of stuff going on. Take your pick. Sometimes when you feel like you're surrounded, when you feel like you're overwhelmed, when you feel like there's a ton going on, all you can really do is be strong and courageous, and may the Lord do what's good in his sight. And basically, Joab just tells his men, you know, we're going to do our best, but ultimately it's in God's hands. This is one of the few high moments of Joab's life where he really says and does the right thing. But I think it's a good model for us for when you feel overwhelmed and surrounded, You know, God's given you resources, friends, family, ability. You do what you can, but ultimately leave the result in his hands. That's a big difference between relying on yourself too much versus just turning it over to God. So that's the second thing we're looking at. Quick victory against Amnon. Again, Joab recognizes who God is. He's a great military commander. 2 Samuel chapter 11. Fast forwarding through David's life. Lightning speed here. Verse 15. We get to the part with Bathsheba and Uriah, and David wants to kill him. So Joab, in verse 15, he's sending the message back. He said, or David is sending a message to Joab using Uriah in verse 15. He had written in the letter saying, place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and withdraw from him so that he may be struck down and die. In verse 16, so it was as Joab kept watch on the city that he put Uriah at the place where he knew there were valiant men. The men of the city went out and fought against Joab, and some of the people fell among David's servants, and Uriah the Hittite also died. Verse 18, then Joab sent and reported to David all the events of the war, and he charged the messenger, saying, when you have finished telling all the events of the war to the king, and if it happens that the king's wrath rises and he says, why did you go so near the city to the fight? Did you not know they would shoot from the wall? Who struck down Abimelech, the son of, again, a name I can't pronounce, why then did you go so near the wall? You shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. This is Uriah, the husband of Bathsheba. After David takes her, he decides to murder her. Again, Joab is an excellent military commander because when he writes back, he goes, the king's going to be upset because I bungled and did this thing and he knows that's out of character for me, but just tell him, well, I killed Uriah for you. Here we see again, like I talked about, one of Joab's finest qualities is also one of his worst, which is he is extremely loyal to David. And Joab gets a letter that just basically says, hey, by the way, would you murder this guy for me? And Joab goes, sure. And it says, not just Uriah, several of David's servants fell. So Joab didn't just kill Uriah, he killed a bunch of other guys with him. But it was like, well, it's what David wants, I guess. It's fine. Really willing to commit violence, really placed his loyalty in the wrong places. I think that it's interesting that, again, Joab appears to skate free with this. God comes to David after this, says, you've committed this horrible sin, I'm going to judge you, here's all this judgment I'm casting on it. The guy who actually did the murdering? Woo! Lucky! Got off! But we'll see, he didn't really. He's completely complicit in Uriah's murder. Really a dark time there. Not a good thing at all. Fast forward to chapter 12, verses 27 to 30. This is after David has been judged by God. God comes and says, you've committed adultery with Bathsheba. You've murdered Uriah. Now this is my punishment on you. And he's mourning because his son dies and everything. And Joab is again out waging war. Verse 27 says, Joab sent messengers to David and said, I have fought against Rabbah. I have even captured the city of waters. Now, therefore, gather the rest of the people together and camp against the city and capture it, or I will capture the city myself, and it will be named after me. Verse 29, so David gathered all the people and went to Rabbah and fought against it and captured it. Then he took the crown of their king from his head, and its weight was a talent of gold, and in it was a precious stone, and it was placed on David's head, and he brought out the spoil of the city in great amounts. So there's this big political fallout. David takes Bathsheba as his wife when he shouldn't, murders Uriah, thinks he gets away with it. God shows up and says, no, you didn't. Here's your punishment. The baby that you, as a result of this, is going to die. And I'm going to make sure that violence never departs from your house. David is then in mourning for this child. Joab is still out waging war with the people against the city. And he says, I captured their water supply. And if you're besieging a city and they can't drink water, they're going to give up real quick. And he sends messages to David and says, you need to get here real quick so that you're the one to take the city, or otherwise the people are going to give me all the credit and they're going to name the city after me and you need to be the one to take the credit. Even though Joab is the one who has led the army to take the city and do all these things. Again, we see Joab is very loyal to David. And Joab is also very cunning in that he is recognizing politically, the situation's not great. I'm sure word has spread through Israel that the king has done some shady stuff and that God is judging him and the prophet Nathan showed up and did you hear the child died and blah, 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 blah. It's not looking good for David. And Joab goes, David, you need a win here. Why don't you come and take this city for me? Because even though I've done all the work to get here, you're the one who needs the credit for it. Again, we see Joab can be extremely loyal and selfless at times when he thinks it's going to benefit him politically. which is a little bit of a strange paradox. Fast forward again to 2 Samuel chapter 18, verse 10 to 14. God's prophecy to David comes true. The sword of violence does not depart from his house. David's own children rebel against him, one named Absalom in particular. This whole situation comes about again as a result of David's unwillingness to deal with problems in his own house. To make a real long story real short, he had one kid who raped his half-sister. David found out about it and was upset and did nothing. So then another kid who got mad at the first kid murdered him for the rape of his sister and then fled. And again, David did nothing. And then through some more circumstances, he gets that kid back. That kid ends up rebelling against David. And David is still having mercy and says, whenever you go to fight this, my kid who's rebelled against me, make sure that you don't hurt him or defeat him. But in verse 10 of chapter 18 of 2 Samuel, it says, when a certain man saw it, he told Joab and said, behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak, because he got caught by his hair. Verse 11, then Joab said to the man who told him, now behold, you saw him. Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? And I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. The man said to Joab, even if I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put out my hand against the king's son. For in your hearing, the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, protect for me the young man Absalom. Otherwise, if I had dealt treacherously against his life and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. Then Joab said, I will not waste time here with you. So he took 3 spears in his hand and he thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. Again, Joab is quick to commit violence. David wanted to show mercy. Joab wouldn't. Joab, you are going to find repeatedly throughout his life, whenever he determines that a person is worthless, he is ready to just either murder them or certainly mistreat them. And he reaches this threshold where it's like, well, they've crossed a line. They're just kind of an idiot, and I just want to dispose of them. He does it with Absalom. He does it with Abner. He's going to do it with another guy named Amasa later. It's just as soon as they trip his trigger to the point of like, this guy's a no good, fine, I want nothing to do with him. I don't tend to go around murdering people I don't like. That's not a thing I've done a whole lot of. Just the once or twice. But what I do run into a lot with myself is, have you ever encountered people and after you've dealt with them for very long, you sort of determine this person's sort of a worthless idiot? I have. Family members, friends, different people that you encounter, you're just like, this person is worthless. I don't want anything to do with them. And I think a lot of times in the story of David and Joab, there is this contrast between David's heart and Joab's head. And David is constantly wanting to reach out with mercy and love to people, maybe even sometimes more than he should, because frankly, probably Absalom did deserve to die, and to show him mercy after he'd rebelled and murdered his brother and then caused the deaths of, again, untold hundreds or thousands of people, and again, the giant civil war and rebellion that had taken place, and it's all Absalom's fault, and David wants to show him mercy. Maybe that's a little bit much, but again, it shows David's heart that he wants to be forgiving and merciful. And Joab tends to categorize people. And if he decides someone's good and worth following, like David, boy, he's going to follow him to the end no matter what. But if he determines that someone is worthless, then he just sort of casts them to the side and wants nothing to do with them. And I think the correct answer is a little more in between. We have to have a balance where we are able to not necessarily become entangled with bad company and allow them to influence our lives in negative ways. But we also need to remember people have value. And it's really easy to dismiss people because they don't meet our standards or they're not up to our snuff and then treat them as being worthless. And I don't think that's how God would have us to do things at all. Later on, Joab goes and murders another commander of the army named Amasa. We're going to skip that for the sake of time, but basically David appoints a different commander because Joab killed Absalom. And Joab doesn't like that, and the new commander is ineffective. He's not rallying the people quickly enough, so Joab just shows up and kills him right in front of the army. And then Joab's brother is like, if you want to follow Joab and David, then just come with us, but otherwise stay here. And everybody just follows him again, where you're like, Joab must have been quite the inspiring general, because it was like they just murdered the dude in cold blood, and everyone's like, well, whatever, we know Joab will bring victory. And he does. He goes and wins the battle. And again, you know what David does? Nothing. You're just like, this is amazing. This is amazing what this guy does, and just keeps getting away with it. 2 Samuel 24, all the way to the end of the book in 2 Samuel. This is a strange passage, but David in his old age is either scared or worried or prideful or something, but he wants to take a census of the people and find out how big and strong the nation of Israel is. This is a no-no from God. God says, you trust in me, not in your strength and numbers, not in the size of your army. In verse 2 of chapter 24, it says, the king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, go about now through all of the tribes of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, and register the people, that I may know the number of the people. And verse 3, I can't help but think that Joab is thinking about a certain Hittite named Uriah that he was told to do something to. And he says, but Joab said to the king, now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of my lord the king still see. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing? Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the commanders of the army. Joab and the commanders of the army are saying, do not do this. Why would you want to do that? That's a terrible idea. But then it says, so Joab and the commanders of the army went out from the presence of the king to register the people of Israel. And it talks about they go from one end of the nation to the other, and they bring back this big report and say, yep, this is how many people there are. And then God is very angry with David and comes and strikes the people with a plague that kills tens of thousands of people. And again, lays it at the feet of David. Once again, this time Joab tries to do a little bit better and goes, are you sure you want to do that? That doesn't sound like a good idea at all. That sounds like something that would make God very angry. He wouldn't even speak up when it was Uriah the Hittite. Now he's at least talking. But again, Joab caves and places his loyalty in David, not in God. Joab knows what's right. He does it the wrong thing anyways, and all Israel suffers. We're going to look at one last thing, and that's the end of Joab's life in 1 Kings chapter 2, just a couple chapters over in the next book. David is dying. He is on his deathbed, and he is talking to his son Solomon, who is about to take over the throne for him. And in 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 5, he is talking to Solomon. He says, now you also know what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me, what he did to 2 commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner, the son of Ner, and to Amasa, the son of Jether, whom he killed. He also shed the blood of war in peace, and he put the blood of war on his belt and about his waist and on his sandals and on his feet. So act according to your wisdom, and do not let his gray hair go down to Sheol in peace. Sheol is a term for death. In other words, don't let him die in bed, is a way another translation put it. And Solomon makes good on it. He chases down Joab. Joab tries to hide in the temple of God, and Solomon's men just go in there and kill him anyways. And that seed of vengeance that Joab had sown throughout his entire life, he reaped again, because finally, as David is old and dying, David refused to deal with him in his lifetime, but he charges his son, Joab has done so many things deserving of death, go take care of him. And Solomon does and kills Joab. David was quick to sow mercy, Joab was quick to sow vengeance, they both reaped in kind. And David used the same standard against Joab that Joab had used against others all his life, and that was, you're a worthless person, and we're going to get rid of you. I also couldn't help but think that verse Christ talks about, those who live by the sword also die by the sword. Boy, if anybody lived by the sword, it was Joab. He was just a murdering, fighting, warring dude, and that was how he ended up dying. At the end of the story, when I get done with all of this, I was asking myself the question, was Joab a believer? Was he actually someone who followed God? And the truthful answer is, I don't know. It doesn't clearly necessarily say one way or the other. He talks about the Lord his God, and he talks about serving him, and there's no indication that he was necessarily someone who worshipped idols or false gods. I'd like to think so, but if he was certainly a very flawed one, certainly one who looked at things with human conditions and looked at very surface-level things, did not keep in mind God. He kept in mind the political situation. He kept in mind how people might react. He kept in mind the situation horizontally all around him. He rarely was one who was considering God's perspective. But I want to give six applications from the life of Joab. Like I said, he's an interesting character, and if I was to draw six things from this for our lives today, this would be it from these highlights we've looked at. The first one is, do not pursue vengeance. Do not pursue vengeance. Romans 12, 17 to 19 says, never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Joab was quick to take vengeance. Again, in today's society, you and me in this room, I would hope, are not running around murdering people we have grievances with. However, how many of you have been at work and been wronged by a coworker? Yeah, I only worked with one and it still happened. But how many of you then later down the road, you're dealing with the boss and they ask you, what do you think of so-and-so? And boy, you're ready. You're ready. You're ready to jump in there and put them down, or in a quick conversation, or in a quip that you can throw out, or in a cutting remark you can make later. Yeah, we don't run around murdering people, but we are quick to go tit for tat sometimes, and that is absolutely not what God would have us to do. We need to forgive and move on from things. Do not pursue vengeance. And again, sometimes we are wronged in minor ways. Sometimes we are wronged in really deep, hurtful, meaningful ways, the kind of ways you would like to murder someone over. Either way, we need to leave vengeance in the hand of God, recognize that God is the source of justice, not us. Not us. Do not pursue vengeance. The second application I would draw from the life of Joab is that we need to speak truth even when it is hard. Joab would have prevented so much evil if he had spoken up to King David in the case of Uriah or in the case of the census. Not speaking truth to power is cowardly, and our world is desperately in need of truth. And if Joab would have said, hey, that is not right. I am not just going to murder some dude just because you said so. And no, that is not right. I am not going to take a census. God would not have us do that. He would have prevented so much evil. Instead, he just went with the flow because it was kind of hard to speak up to the king when the king asked you to do something. You need to speak truth even when it's hard. We don't have kings, but again, we have coworkers, we have friends, we live in a society, and a lot of times stupid, nonsensical things get said, and it's real easy to just button up and go, well, I don't want to be the one that disagrees with everyone nodding along going, yeah, that sounds great to me. Speaking truth is hard, but it is important, and it's most important to speak truth when it is hard. And I would encourage us as Christians and believers, we need to be sources of truth, and the Bible talks about speaking truth in love, so we don't want to be beating people over the head with it, but we do not want to acquiesce to lies either. Speak truth even when it is hard. Do not pursue vengeance. Speak truth even when it's hard. The third one is, you are responsible for disciplining those under you. Whether it is at home, in church, at work, or in our families, it is up to us to discipline those who are we in our authority. Again, once again, to not do so as cowardly. David caused so many problems by not dealing with people under him. I have four children. If I am in the midst of doing something, I am working on the computer, I am watching a television show, I can hear the ruckus start in the next room. They don't. Ever. And if you just are like, well, maybe it'll get better. 5 minutes later, it's louder and not better. And maybe I'll deal with it after I finish this thing. 5 minutes later, someone is screaming bloody murder and running through the room about what so-and-so did. It is your responsibility to discipline people under you. And that can come from raising your kids. That can come in a whole classroom if you're a teacher. That can come with those under you at work or in church or whatever. It is hard to correct people, but it is important to do so, because when you ignore a situation, it just spirals out of control and gets worse and worse and worse. And you can watch it happen in small situations like families with kids. You can watch it happen with large organizations. Big, successful churches can be taken down from the inside if the leadership allows people to just sin and live in stupidity and refuses to discipline anybody. You are responsible for disciplining those under you. The fourth thing, and this is a really important one for the season we are in, is give your loyalty to God, not people. Give your loyalty to God, not to people. I think this cuts both ways, Joab towards David, and also David is really loyal towards Joab. Even when Joab does all sorts of bad things, David never deals with him until David's finally dying. Then he asks his son to. And it's really easy to put our hope and our loyalty into a political figure, and we should be putting it in God. Doesn't mean we don't need to pay attention during election seasons or whatever, but at the same time, you want to put your loyalty in God because that's the one you're following, not blindly following after a person. And it doesn't just happen with politics. I've seen it happen with churches. I've seen it happen with families, and somebody gets, oh, this pastor, he is the most amazing thing ever. And so they are all about that. The problem is people will always eventually mess up because they're people. And you need to make sure your loyalty is to God, not to a person. The fifth thing is that God cares about our heart far more than our abilities. God cares about our heart far more than our abilities. David is described as the man after God's own heart because he's pursuing God. Joab is a man of great ability. He's a great leader. He's very sharp politically. He's a great military commander. He does a lot of great things. He was not called a man after God's own heart. God cares about your heart, and are you pursuing him, not about what talents or abilities that you have. He can fill in the gaps of the talents and the abilities, but he needs a willing heart. And Joab was shown continually to be a man of great ability whose heart was not always in the right place. And the last thing is don't dismiss people. Don't dismiss people. I find myself, like I said, not murdering people, but oftentimes putting people into a category of they're worthless and I want nothing to do with them. God never dismisses anyone. God always pursues people. And we need to as well. As a church, as believers, we need to be welcoming to those that are rejected. And it's really easy to just categorize people as they're worthless and I don't want anything to do with them. So the six applications from Life of Joab are do not pursue vengeance. Speak truth even when it's hard. You are responsible for disciplining those under you. Give your loyalty to God, not to people. God cares about our heart far more than our abilities, and don't dismiss people. Thank you for taking a quick look at the life of Joab with me. I'm going to close in a word of prayer, and then we'll be ready for a service. God, I thank you today for the characters that your Bible is filled with, your word is filled with, because they are all human, just like us. And they all have positive sides and weaknesses and struggles, just like us. They're so relatable from David to Moses to Joab to anyone we look at, God. We find them being human and having flaws and failings just as we do. And we find you, a perfect, holy, and loving God, willing to help them and willing to use them even in the midst of their imperfections and flaws and failures. God, we ask that you would help us to be people after your heart who are pursuing what you would want, because God, ultimately that matters to you far more than any abilities that we have. And I just ask that you would help us to allow you to use us and to be willing to be used by you. Thank you for the many good things you've given us, and bless our time in the service to come. In your name we pray. Amen.